Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 22nd, 2006. Today's Elder Hostel Health and Wellness session is entitled End of Life Issues, presented by Cliff Hall. Let's listen in.
Fifth and final session of the health and wellness portion of the Elder Hostel group. And I'd like to take this chance this time. If I don't thank people at the beginning of something, I usually forget by the end. So I do want to express my appreciation to the Elder Hostel organization for getting this program off the ground, the Holden Village to this very beautiful site. I went out early this morning and walked out here, and the sun was just coming up and hitting those mountain peaks, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful experience. We're just so fortunate. I want to express my appreciation to Carol, Paul, and Tom, the directors here. To Gay, who I couldn't have done this without her, I wouldn't be here without her, and she's really been an inspiration in my life, and I think that's obvious to all of you. Marion, thank you very, very much. Well, that's Marion, it's always a delight to work with Marion. You never know what she's going to say, and you certainly don't know what she's going to wear. You don't even know what she's going to look like when she meets you at the bus, so... It's always a delight.
Pretty scary.
It is that too. Jim's not here, but I think he's added a dimension to our program that we haven't had in previous years, and I think that's been great. And Dave Cleaver, who isn't here physically, but obviously has been here and has been part of this. This is really kind of special because I feel many of you kind of know Dave, even though you've never met him, and you know about him, and you know what an influence he's had on a number of people. Is there anybody else? No. Mm-hmm. I was going to say something about Don, but...
It's Dan, not Don.
Oh, Dan, geologist Dan. Well, you know, this coming to Holden in many ways is a humbling experience. You know, we're such tiny, insignificant creatures, and we look up at these huge mountains around us, and for physicians who have these inflated egos, as I'm sure you know.
Or erect egos.
We're not going to discuss that.
Erect egos.
Usually it's the other way around. Usually I'm making those off-color comments, not Gay. But,
that's a poetry term.
Yeah. But you know, coming up here and going head to head against a geologist like Don is really difficult. And you know, reading what Ann Landers has to say about geologists, I think you all read that. You know that they're intelligent, sensitive, creative. They love pets. They love children. They do the laundry at home. I mean, they're just so fantastic. I've noticed there's an abundance of women in this group, and I've noticed the attention that Don has been getting. That, you know, there's all these women just kind of, and every word, you know, they're just there, you know, talking about rocks and things, how can I compete with that, you know? But I want to give you women some warning. You know, however great landers have said geologists are, and however great we know they are, if you get hooked up with them, not always does it go well. You know, and sometimes these geologist marriages
are pretty rocky.
They go on the rocks. Very good, Marion. Yeah, they get kind of rocky. Is right, and you know, and if worst comes to worst, it ends. It can end in a separation and a divorce. And in every single case, this has been well studied. I have all the literature on this. And this is scientifically proven. In every single case, when a geologist gets divorced, the geologist gets the gold mine, and the wife gets the shaft. So Don, it's a pleasure working with you, Don. You know, Don, the other thing about one of the things we said, that something important in longevity is to appreciate music, and that's clearly part of Holden too, is with the Vespers and the music. And you know, it's geologists are musicians at heart. They really are. In fact, most musicians are geologists. They don't always know it, but Gay, you know what the geologist's favorite song is?
Rock Around the Clock?
No, that's pretty good, Gay. I mean, right, that's pretty good.
And, she's reading your notes.
Well, you're damn right.
I just have to glance at it.
You know, we're not that smart. We don't practice these things, Marion, like you do. What do you think Don's favorite rock group is?
The Rolling Stones.
Oh, of course. Yeah, great.
Say, Cliff. From a woman's perspective, as a baby, what is the first song a geologist learns?
Rock-a-bye baby. Yes, rock-a-bye baby. And that gets these little geologists off to a good start. But, you know, geologists, like most of us, you know, go through our teenage rebellious years and may even end up in jail, you know. Most commonly, they end up in jail. Why do you think they end up in jail?
Because that's how they learn to sing Jailhouse.
No. That's because they got stoned. What do they sing when they're in jail?
Jailhouse Rock,
yeah. That's a pretty bad gig. How about when a geologist finally gets out of jail and gets married and goes on a honeymoon? What's the theme song of the honeymoon?
I want you to know this is original. He wrote this. A Sedimental Journey.
And what else do they sing along the way? Oh, Sedimental Me. You know that song, Sedimental Me? That's okay. Well, I guess
that's the end.
That's the end, I guess. All right.
Are you still with us, Don? He left.
But it really is a pleasure to work with geologist Dan over there. We have fun and it's a great opportunity, and I'm really grateful for that chance to be up here. We're gonna move into a branch of medical ethics. I left the four basic principles. I just want to emphasize those again, because all of us in our lives will be dealing with and thinking about things, whether it's stem cell research or whether it's end-of-life issues or whether it's abortion or birth control, whatever kinds of issues we have, and there will be many new ones as technology advances. If we try to frame it in the terms, not of whether this is right or wrong, or black or white or whatever, or what something in the Bible said, or what some expert said someplace, or what the president said, or what the congressman said. Really, there are some principles in which we can judge. And the great conflicts, the great dilemmas, will be when there is conflict between two goods. It's not good and evil. It's a conflict between two goods. And that's the thing we have to recognize. And then, for different people, they will weight these goods differently. Someone may say the most important thing is justice. We have to be equal to everybody else. And someone else is saying, no, it's personal, individual autonomy. It's what I want. It's the rights that I can choose for myself. And someone else is saying, no, that's not. And that's going to be where the conflict is. And if you can address it in those terms and look for the common ground, I think almost everyone I know that thinks about it, talks about these issues, even though they may come down on entirely opposite sides of an issue, can agree on the principles. And then you're discussing the principles as opposed to getting into some very specifics that kind of get you off where you really want to be in your discussion. So try to think about those principles. Beneficence is to good, and think of it in the terms that I use, which is to do good, don't do bad, patient autonomy is our respect for individuals, and justice is how do we treat people fairly and equitably. Before we go into a couple things, I'd just like to tie up a couple loose ends. We had a discussion the other night about supplements and things of that sort. The FDA does not regulate supplements. It does regulate vitamins. So somebody said, how do you know you're getting a 500 milligrams of vitamin C and a vitamin C? There is regulation of the vitamins. There's certainly regulation of all your prescription medicines and over-the-counter medicines, things like aspirin and Tylenol. Those are all regulated by the FDA. They do not regulate by mandate of Congress. They are not allowed to regulate anything that's considered a food supplement. So all the things like echinacea, ginkgo biloba, ginseng, all those kind of things. That's a total buyer beware out there. You have no idea what you're really getting.
Are there any companies that can get theirs, approved or regulated or stamped, good housekeeping or something like that, any particular companies, like selling?
Some of the larger companies that are hooked up with the big chains, so that if you go to Costco and their brands, they are fairly reliable. As far as I know, they're very reliable. I'm not advertising for Costco, but those companies have made an effort to deal with reputable pharmaceutical suppliers. But there's just a lot of stuff that's unknown and a lot of claims that are out there. We didn't get into that. That was sort of an informal discussion that we had one evening, but I just wanted to straighten that out. And I did want to say something that influences in this. It came up yesterday, and this will deal with end-of-life issues, and that's physicians praying with or for their patients. And I think we should be very clear about that, when a physician-patient relationship is a very unequal relationship. Physician has a huge amount of knowledge that the patient doesn't have and can distribute that knowledge as he or she wants to distribute it and present it in terms of the way he or she wants to present it. To interject religion into that situation, if there is not a true consensual relationship, is, in my opinion, and in most medical ethicists' opinion, very inappropriate. So it may be fine if you know your physician well and he attends the same church with you and you have a long-term relationship that the two of you pray together in church and you have other relationships, and then that I think is perfectly fine and perfectly acceptable and may be very helpful in the healing relationship. But I think it's very dangerous for a physician to institute that. A patient can ask a physician for anything. A physician can either feel comfortable in doing it or not doing it, but I think for a physician to say, would you like me to pray for you, this just before you go into surgery, well, what if you say no, and the physician says, well, what's the matter, why don't you want me to? And a physician might do that. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, their physician is kind, gentle, thoughtful, has great bedside manner, knows how to relate to patients. That could create a very unpleasant situation. So I just want to make that, I didn't know if that came across clear. I feel very, very strongly, and there is a significant group of people who definitely don't want their physicians to get involved in their spiritual life. I go to you, doctor, because I know you have some knowledge, some skills. You're going to take out my appendix. If I want to pray, I'll pray by myself. I don't want to pray, I don't want to pray at all. Don't push your religion. And this is a problem with all end-of-life decisions where physicians can have undue influence on how decisions are made. And one little study that was done, they went to, they created a situation in sort of a case study, and they went to 15 lung specialists. I'm trained as a lung specialist. They went to 15 lung specialists and asked them, how would you present to your patients this situation about whether you want to have resuscitation done or not resuscitation done. Virtually every time you go in a hospital, you're going to have to say, are you a code or a no code? Are you a resuscitate status or do not resuscitate status? And how it's presented can make a huge difference. And how it's presented by physicians relates much more to how they feel about things than how they're giving you the chance to make the decision yourself. I can take somebody... I can get them to say whatever they want to say, whatever I want them to say. Let's put it right down to that. Because, and I'll give you an example. I can take a 75-year-old person that comes in with a heart attack, and I can say to that person, well, we need to know whether you want to be resuscitated or not. Now, here's one way I can phrase that. I can say, you know, if your heart stops beating, we can immediately give you some oxygen, breathe for you, put electric shock across your chest, and get your heart going again. Would you want that done? Well, yeah, doc, sure. You know, I mean, I'm here. You know, that's why I'm here. Or I can say, you know, if you have some catastrophic event and your heart stops beating and blood stops going to your brain, you may have some brain damage. Under those circumstances, do you want us to institute heroic therapy in which we pound on your chest, we hook you up to machines, we put electric shocks across your chest, we do a variety of other heroic, invasive, extraordinary measures to try to keep you alive, recognizing that the outcome may not be very good and you might suffer brain damage? Ooh. Now, same thing, same question. What have I done? I have created two entirely different scenarios. I have, in one case, I've discussed it as a, well, it's just kind of a routine kind of thing, and we'll move right in there and take care of it, and it sounds like the outcome's going to be great. The other one, I'd say, well, it's kind of heroic, and the outcome is very uncertain. And how I present that, how your physician presents that, how any physician presents that, is going to influence you in a very significant way. Don't, I'm not saying this to scare you, I'm not saying this to say that physicians, I'm just saying that you have to think about these things in advance, about what you want, what, and have those discussions, not at the time that it's, that, my God, I got to make this decision right now, you know, if they don't make this decision right now, I'm going to die, they've got to do this under the pressure. You've got to have those discussions with your family members, with your doctors, with your healthcare providers, in a more leisurely, more relaxed kind of setting. Yes, Don?
Keeping in mind that what's up on the board behind you right there says medical ethics, you've just posed these two scenarios. Could you comment which one of those you'd take if it was me that came in?
Well, no, Don brings up a good point. If it were Don, right. I would say, what are you doing here, Don? You don't have insurance. So, and when it comes to that, so what should a physician do? A physician should present the facts as much as he can without giving his opinion, unless you ask him for his opinion. Okay, so what he should say is that you're coming to the hospital. We don't expect that anything adverse is going to happen. But if something does happen, here's what might happen, and here's what the options are. Mm-hmm. One option is that we do everything to try to resuscitate you, and another option is that, you know, dying suddenly may not be the worst thing. And it depends on, it's a 50-year-old person with a heart attack that's very different from a 97-year-old person that has underlying cancer and dementia that comes in with a heart attack. Those are two very, very different things, and the decisions are going to be very, very different. But there's a lot of factors that go into these things, and again, it's a plea for dealing with these issues not at the time of an acute crisis, but deal with them in advance. The other thing that I will bring up right now, because I may not mention it as we go along in our discussions, is. Lost its senior moment, huh? That's, it's about. Yeah, it comes back if you wait long enough. Sometimes it doesn't come back. Sometimes you meet new friends that are your old friends. we're generally, with the exception of Don over here, we're generally an elderly group of people here. The women look young, but the men look old. Except for Don. The great crises, the Karen Ann Quinlan cases, the Nancy Cruzan cases, the Terry Schiavo cases, they've all been with young people. And none of them had advanced directives. None of them had signed living wills. None of them. And so we have all this emphasis, you know, we all get to be 50, 60, 70, we're all signing, filling out these advanced directives, and it turns out hardly ever, and thousands of us are dying every year, and they're dying in all kinds of difficult situations where families are struggling with, you know, resuscitate, to continue ventilation, to remove life support. Those things happen all the time, and the courts almost never get involved. The crises are in young people who didn't fill anything out. Because that's where there's a lot of emotion gets involved in these cases. So you have children, you have grandchildren. I think you should encourage them to think about these things, to fill out some of these advanced directives. There's nothing about age that says that you shouldn't, just because you're 25 years old or 30 years old, that something bad might not happen to you. In fact, the way the young kids drive automobiles, head injuries are not uncommon. And that's a common issue that we face. Yes?
If I am in your hands, would you give me an opinion if I said, well, how about you, Doc? What do you say?
Absolutely.
You think a doctor should give an opinion?
That's a great question. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think it must be very difficult for her.
It is perfectly legitimate for a physician to say, if this were my mother, this is what I would do. But I don't think that's the way he should start off the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that he should start off the conversation saying, you know, I don't think we should, or I think we ought to put Mary on a ventilator here, and here's the reasons why, and this, and now, what do you think? I think the physician has to say, you know, we have some options. Here's the options. Here's the situation. Here's the background. Here's the information you need, or at least some that I think what you need. And, you know, what would Grandma want if she could make the decision for us, for herself?
Can I say one thing?
Sure.
I just want to say that when you're in the hospital and someone you love is in the hospital and it's a parent or a spouse, it's much easier to stop things from happening before they happen. Once the tubes are in, once they're hooked up, it's extraordinarily difficult to go the other way. If you don't want that to happen and they don't want that to happen, say so before it happens.
Because ethically is no difference,
but it's
practically
very hard to stop it once it's going.
It's hard to remove the feeding tube. It's hard to take the...
So if you don't want that done,
flip the switch,
say so,
as they say, you know.
Immediately. Don't let them just... And they'll do it without even asking you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that just to call 911 infers that you do want resuscitation.
Yeah. Exactly.
Good point.
Exactly.
Good point. Has anybody seen this? Probably you live in Oregon if you have, or you know somebody.
They're green. They're green in Washington.
They're green in Washington. Okay. These really stand out. This is called the Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, POLST. Several states have these. Oregon had it first, and Washington has adopted it. I'm sorry?
She wouldn't know where to get them.
Good question. I only have one.
But the hospitals have them.
Hospitals will have them. Probably your fire department has them, the people that send the EMTs out. This is the reason I brought it, because it's a question of the EMT. If an EMT, if you call 911 and the EMTs arrive, they are going to do everything. They're going to use all their advanced training to resuscitate, to save the life of the person that's there. They're not going to ask a lot of questions. They are trained to do that, and it's appropriate that they do that. Under certain circumstances, and it's frequently a hospice patient, in which case you probably should never call 911 anyway, but occasionally it happens. But someone else that has a terminal illness or end stage or severe dementia or the kinds of things that you don't want heroic therapy done, but they might have fallen and broken a leg, or they might be having some chest pain, and you certainly want the EMTs to come and transport the patient to be evaluated. You know, being transported to the emergency room is very different from saying, yeah, hook me up to all kinds of life support. If you fill out one of these things, and it has to be signed by a physician, then this becomes an order. This is an order, and then the EMTs have legal cover for not doing what they're trained to do. And there's things in there like comfort measures only, full treatment, going to give antibiotic, going to give artificial nutrition. There's a number of things on here that... And it's bright colored, whether it's a bright green or an orange. You can stick it on the refrigerator if there's some question about, or you can have it somewhere where it's visible. So when the EMTs arrive for Grandma, you can, and while they're attending Grandma, Grandma has a heart attack and stops breathing. Well, everybody that knows Grandma says, what a relief, finally. She's going to wherever she's going to go. It was quick, it was sudden, she didn't suffer very long, it's acceptable. And there's the EMTs pounding on her chest, bagging her, putting tubes into her, and say, oh my God, stop, stop. And they won't stop. They won't stop. You can say, she didn't want it. They won't stop, because they can't. Legally, they can't. Okay? Just so you know that. If you have one of these things, you can say, look, this, the order that was signed by the physician, did not want resuscitation, right at the top. Resuscitate, do not attempt resuscitation, right at the very top. If that's there, that's signed by a physician, and they're pretty sure that this really is Grandma, you know, and not Mary that just happened to be visiting that day, Grandma's house. All right. Yes?
When my father died, he died suddenly while I was sitting in a chair, but they immediately, my mom and the person that was installing new television, they did call 911. my brother, he was working downtown, immediately come home, the MTs were working on him. He said, stop. He says, we cannot stop. He went into the bedroom, pulled out the piece of paper, handed it to the mechs, and they stopped.
There's the testimonial that it actually works. I'm sorry?
What do you call it again?
It's a POLST. It's the physician's order. See, and it's and so that gives them legal cover. Because if they don't do it, someone's going to turn around and sue the fire department for $10 million for having not done everything that they were trained to do. And they have no defense in court. Why? They might as well just write a check. So that's why, so it's not that the EMTs are insensitive or don't understand or won't listen to the family, but if you don't think about this in advance and don't do this, then things can happen to you. Yeah. Now, it's not the end of, that's not the right expression,
not the end of the world.
It might be the end of your world, but it's not the worst thing in the world that the EMTs do all that, drag this unconscious patient into the emergency room, where the emergency room doctor can then have a couple minutes to talk to the family, and when the family arrives, and the family says, "Mama never wanted this. It was just be inappropriate, you know." The physician then can say, "Walk into the room. Let's stop everything because this was inappropriate." And so there might have been a 20-minute or a half hour, an hour of a lot of activity, a lot of unnecessary activity in one way, but on the other hand, the decision gets made in a proper fashion. So it isn't a horrible thing that happens. It isn't ideal. Ideal is when everybody's on the same page.
Our hospital always requests, or they require, a signature or a living will to be signed when you register.
That is a federal regulation now. Everybody that comes in the hospital has to be offered that information. They're not required to fill out a living will, but they have to be offered information about the living will. And one of the handouts here, I had a few little stack of the ones from our hospital system that everybody gets when they come.
What we have done is filled them out, given one to everybody that should be notified, but one to the doctor, and sent one to the hospital so they have it in their files.
Important.
Is that the same thing as that?
No, that's something different. This is a physician. This has to be signed by a physician. The other ones, the other advanced directives and power of attorney is not signed by a physician. That is what the patient signs, the individual signs, as to direct healthcare providers in the future what their preferences would be. Under certain circumstances, it's the most important. It is, I know of no case that I've practiced over 30 years doing intensive care unit, dealing with literally hundreds, if not several thousand, patients that have died in my career. I know of no case in which, if somebody had filled one of those things out, that we had to then go to court with that. Mm-hmm. It's rare that you ever go to court anyway. It's extraordinarily rare. I mean, these cases are just the total exception to the general rule. But what they are most useful for, and it's hardly ever we hardly ever use them, even if you filled it out. Because if you filled it out, you have to discuss it with someone else, because you have to have a couple witnesses. You have to pick somebody, a child, a brother, a sister, a spouse, your best friend, who's going to make those decisions for you if you couldn't make them. And so you have to have that discussion with that person. They have to sign it. That's the most important thing, by far. Just have that discussion so that when the bad time comes and somebody has to make a decision, it's not like, well, Neil never said a word about what he wanted. You know, I never heard him ever discuss it. I mean, Neil went through his whole life. I'm picking on you, Neil. I could pick on Dawn. I usually pick on Dawn. I don't know, you guys have to be in that general direction. He got to be 60 years old, and I guess he thought he would never die. You know, I mean, there was no reason to talk about it. But if you have those discussions, people are gonna know how you feel. Yes?
I noticed our attorney suggested, requested that you do that and said keep it with your will.
Yeah, it's fine. Where you keep it is great. I mean, you know, and they will always say keep it in a safe place, give a copy to your lawyer, copy to your doctor, copy to the hospital, copy to the fire department, you know, copy to the church. No one ever is going to read it, because if you've done it, we don't need it. It's sort of like the paradox of a lot of things. If you do it, you don't need it. You know, if you wear your seatbelt, you never need it.
But how do they know?
Yeah, you don't know, but have the discussion. That's the important thing. And this kind of forces you into having the discussion.
In Montana now, it's online, so that any health provider in the state with the appropriate password can access your information.
That's great.
Traveling so much and living in one part of the country one part of the year and another part of the country.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And lots of times you're separated from where
And how do you record it if you have
Choices.org.
Choices.org.
There's an organization, at least in our state, where you submit it in writing. You fill out a form, and then this organization puts it online. And you can change it, of course, anytime you want, but it is handy and
it's there.
I was unaware. Thank you for letting me know about that. That's,
I didn't hear that. Choices online.
You say that the doctor doesn't know, but they do know, because when they had done everything that they could to keep my husband alive, the doctor came to me and he said, there's nothing more we can do. So I said, okay, then what are my choices? And he said, well, we can keep him in the hospital, we can give you a private room, and he can die there, or, because he knew that it was, we were going to pull, or you can take him to a nursing home, or you can take him to your home. And of course, I chose the hospital, because it was most convenient. But they do know. They do know.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, your doctor should know. But what I'm saying, but you were able to talk to your doctor on a daily basis.
But no, but this was the hospital doctor.
Sure.
This was not my private personal physician.
But if I do really feel it is important, as you mentioned, for young people, because our son had been about 5 years in a bad car bike accident. And he had been airlifted to Harborview and then intubated. And this happened on a Friday. Sunday morning, I knew he was trying to say something, but because he had intubated, he couldn't. But after a little while, the nurse and I figured out he wanted to know, was he paralyzed? And we had discussed that with our children when they were in their teens. What would they want done if something like this had happened? And then when we were able to say no, you could just see the relief on his body. You know, but I do feel it's very important to discuss it, you know, even with your young kids.
Right. And even organ donation too,
yes.
You know, especially with young people, because those are the organs you want, you know, that other people are desperate for. Yeah.
Are photocopies legal?
Yes. Well,
will they hold up?
That's the region. You know, it is so rare that the courts ever get involved in this. It is so rare. Those things are written in legalese and all this kind of thing, and they're under state statute and all this other kind of stuff, so that if they ever do get challenged in court, there's a structure there for it to be interpreted. But it is, I wouldn't think of those things as a, I would think of it more as a living document, and that it's a reflection of your values that you've communicated to those people that are close to you and will be involved, that will be affected by your illness, and who will be involved in decision making if you can't make the decision. And who do you want to make those decisions? And think about that in advance. Who? And it may not be one of your children. It may not be any of your children. You may say, my best friend knows more about me and my values than my kids do. You know, the kids go off, they live in their own lives, they have different values. Sometimes they have very different values. They join different religions, they do all kinds of stuff that's very different. And so you may not want it to be a child. A spouse, you may have that, you may, or, you know, if you're married to a geologist and there's this gold mine shaft kind of thing going on, you know, you might not want your geologist to be making the decision for you.
He's going to put a rock in front of your bus on the way down.
All right.
He's going to throw it through the window.
All right, a few terms. Because if you don't understand the term, this is like if you don't know, what is it? You've got to know your rocks to know geology? You've got to know the terms. Because the terms are the rocks on which we build this whole structure of end-of-life issues. Four terms regarding your state of your mental function when you look like you're not really paying attention. Now, if you're awake and alert, you know, you're awake and alert, you may not be all that bright. Sleep, coma, a persistent or permanent vegetative state, and brain dead. Up until about 10, 12, 15 years ago, persistent vegetative state was just lumped into coma. Now this is very important. This really is very important. Sleep. Somebody's lying there. They look like they're breathing, but they're not eating. They're not talking. But you can shake them, and they wake up. Now, why are you shaking me? And they talk to you. That's sleep. We all know what sleep is. Coma. They're lying there. They're not moving. They're not talking. They're not eating. You shake them, and they just lie there. And you shake them, and you shake them, and you squeeze their toes, and you push on their chest, and you poke on their eyes. They don't wake up. They're in coma. Same thing with these people. They don't wake up. They're in coma. So coma can be a broad term. If they are not, if they're still breathing, but there is no evidence of any brainstem activity, no other brainstem activity, then they're brain dead, and they're dead, and we no longer deal with those people. They're there for organ transplant or for burial. The heart may still be beating for a while. And if you hook them up to a machine, you can breathe for them. And if you hook them up to a machine and put a feeding tube in them, you can keep the body alive for a while, probably for a matter of days if you're brain dead. But then without a functioning brain, without a functioning brain stem, the body will deteriorate and you will die. But every state in the union, if you have no evidence of brain stem activity, no spontaneous ventilation, no pupillary responses, no movement of the eyes, no evidence of brain activity on a brainwave test, then you are brain dead. You are legally dead. Your heart can be beating, and you'd be hooked to a machine, and so the body looks like just somebody in coma, but you are legally dead. That way, they can take you down to the operating room and remove your organs and then send the corpse to the mortuary. But you're already dead.
What's spontaneous ventilation?
I'm sorry?
What's spontaneous ventilation?
Spontaneous ventilation is what we're doing right now. We're just breathing on our own.
Somebody that's brain dead doesn't breathe on their own?
No. Not if you're brain dead. If you're in a persistent vegetative state, or if you're in coma or you're asleep, you breathe on your own because you have brain stem activity. The reptilian brain is working. You may not be thinking, and in cases of persistent vegetative state, you can't think. So what do we know about coma if we actually look at the brain of someone in coma? There are two basic causes for coma. One is traumatic. You get hit on the head. You fall out, you fall down the stairs, you're in a motor vehicle, you get hit on the head, there's a brain injury of some kind, you're unresponsive. But if you look at the brain, most of the brain tissue is there. There may be some blood in some areas, evidence of injury, but the brain is there. The other cause would be not getting enough circulation and oxygen to the brain. That may be because you were drowned, you had a heart attack, and there was no circulation to the brain, or something of that sort. And so that would cause coma. But if you looked at someone in coma and looked at the brainwave, you'd find brainwaves. There's brainwaves going on. The brain's working. It's just not, you're just not waking up. And we can't wake you up. But there is brain activity. In a persistent vegetative state, a person has spontaneous ventilation. They're breathing on their own. They don't need to be hooked up to a machine. Their heart's beating. They have a blood pressure. Things look pretty good as far as the body goes. But they don't wake up. There's no significant response. And if you look at the brain, there's usually extensive injury to the cortex of the brain. That's the outer surface of the brain, the inch and a half that we do all our thinking in and all our activities in. That's not working. Diffusely, that will not be working. And on brainwave tests, there often is very little brain activity. There may be some. Now, again, the basic brain stem is working, but the thinking part of the brain is not. Now, in order to be, so how do we make this distinction between someone in coma and someone in a persistent vegetative state? Well, one thing is we do have some technology that helps us. MRI scans show the shrinkage of the brain or significant injury to the brain. CT scans showed abnormalities in that cortex. Brainwave tests show that there's no activity or hardly any activity in the cortex of the brain. But what's most important is the time, is how long someone has been in that if not showing that activity. Now, if they show a lot of brainwave activity, they can remain in, and we say, okay, it's coma and not persistent vegetative state. They can remain in that for up to 5-10 years and still wake up. No one that's in it longer than a couple years and wakes up ever is anywhere near normal. So this idea, when you read a newspaper, man awakens from coma after 15 years with, you know, injury, you know, and then goes off and does something. Yeah. All the going off is what's not real. He might wake up and kind of look around and respond, but after years in coma, you're not nowhere ever near normal. Okay, I mean, there's just, nobody ever gets back to anything near normal. A persistent vegetative state, nobody wakes up from, ever. Zero. So if you've been in that for 6 months after a anoxic injury, like a heart attack or drowning, or 1 year after a traumatic brain injury, no one ever wakes up. Because you don't have any cortical activity. There's no reason to wake up because there is no cortical activity remaining, and no one will ever wake up under those circumstances. In fact, no one probably ever wakes up after 3 months in it, but they make the legal the medical definition is a year after trauma, 6 months after injury, after anoxic injury. Yes?
Well, I was just wondering, you know, why would somebody even wait the 6 months or a year if somebody is in that,
well,
unless they didn't want.
Well, you wouldn't if somebody had filled something out in advance, and if you had a family member was a surrogate member making the decision, you would say you would have pulled the plug way back. However, in the United States right now, there are 25,000 people in nursing homes on tube feedings, hooked, but not hooked to a machine. They're not on life support, but they are getting tube feedings that are in nursing homes in a persistent vegetative state. They will never, ever wake up. Terry Schiavo was one of those people. She was one of 25,000, made a huge big deal. What about the other 24,999 that nobody heard about? 25,000 is a round number. These are the building blocks, and so we're going to talk about the Terry Schiavo case. We're going to take a break in a minute, but we'll talk about the Terry Schiavo case because it brings up a lot of these issues as we go along. Just wanted to make a couple comments about the treatment or about end-of-life activities, because it's very important, again, to know the terminology so that when you're talking to somebody about something, you understand it. Because if somebody doesn't understand those terms, they're going to come to very strange conclusions. Refusal of life support. Everybody here, the Supreme Court has stated we have the right to refuse life support. We already talked about that with the physician orders that do not resuscitate. We do not have to be hooked up to a machine. Even if all your doctors say that's the right thing to do, you do not have to do it if you're an adult. You can remove the life support. Every ethicist that I know of that's written on this, and I would, again, strongly recommend these two books, How We Die by Sherwin Nuland, and for a more detailed analysis of the ethical principles that are involved, Batten's book on ending life. Great, when they're in your bibliography. Great discussions. But every ethicist that I am aware of makes no distinction whatsoever between withdrawing life support and not starting it in the first place. And you have an absolute right to withdraw. To refuse it, and therefore you have an absolute right to withdraw it. And there's no distinction. But as Gay pointed out a little bit ago, emotionally and operationally is a huge difference between saying, let's not hook Aunt Jane up to the machine, and then when Aunt Jane is already hooked up the machines and the doctor says, do you want us to pull the tube, to pull the plug, whatever euphemistic way of saying, you know, do you want to stop everything and let her die, that's much harder than saying Aunt Jane never would have wanted to be hooked up. But ethically, there's no difference. There is no difference. And that's where this active and passive euthanasia, which I would like to use Jim's expression, I like to bury that dead soldier, and we will bury that dead soldier in just a minute. So withdrawal or refusal of life support, it's the same thing. And you have a right for it. Suicide, I think we all know what suicide is. If you take your own life, you jump off a bridge, blow your brains out, take an overdose of a drug. That is, some people think that's an absolute sin that will send you to hell. Other people think that that's a right that we anybody should have. Physician-assisted suicide, just put PAS, physician-assisted suicide, only one state allows that. That's Oregon. We'll talk a little bit about the Oregon experience. That's where a physician will write a prescription for a medication that would ordinarily be used for something else, but in a dose, in a dosage that would be fatal. Gives this prescription to the patient and says, you can take this patient, you can take this physician, you can take this prescription. That's okay, I've been up here too long. You can take this prescription when you feel you need it. And it will end your life. It has a high probability of ending your life. Obviously, that's an area of great controversy. The state of Oregon has lots of restrictions, so you just can't go in and get that. You have to meet a whole series of criteria. You have to be over 18. You have to have a terminal illness. The terminal illness has to be certified by two physicians that you have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. You have to be certified that you are not crazy or severely depressed. You have to make your request in writing. You have to wait 2 weeks. You got to then make another request orally. You have to then go to a pharmacy, get it filled, and then you can take it. And you can withdraw your request at any time, of course. So there's a host, and then that has to be reported to the state of Oregon, which keeps statistics on that. That's physician-assisted suicide. Only one state allows that. Two states have voted it down. State of Washington, this state right here, voted it down, 59-41 or something like that. A few years ago, state of New York has voted it down. Only Oregon has passed that legislation. Euthanasia. Euthanasia is active, the active good death. It means good death, and we usually use it in terms of somehow a physician involved or a medical person involved giving a lethal dose of a medicine. The physician actually administers the dose, not just writes the prescription and then you take it yourself. So here, if somebody could be severely demented, somebody could have ALS, not be able to actually take a prescription themselves, but it would actually be administered by a physician. No place in the United States is that legal right now. It is legal in the Netherlands. It was legal in the north provinces of Australia, and then it was overturned by their Supreme Court. They had passed it so the only place that I'm aware that it is legal is in the Netherlands. We used to have terms that talked about passive euthanasia and active euthanasia. Active euthanasia, you gave it an injection, the person died. Passive, you withheld medical care that kept them alive. That gets back into this refusal, withdrawal, life support. So we don't use those terms anymore. So if you hear somebody talk about active euthanasia, passive euthanasia, just say, you know, that we don't, those terms are obsolete. We don't use them. But within the euthanasia group, there's voluntary euthanasia. I go to my doctor and say, I'm miserable the way I am. Inject something into me so that I will die. That's voluntary euthanasia, and the physician carries out that request. Non-voluntary would be, I'm demented, I'm in a nursing home. I told Gay, if I ever get into that condition, get the doctor to come and give me a shot and put me away. You would put my dog down, put me down. I don't want to go on this way. And if that were complied upon, that would be non-voluntary euthanasia. Involuntary euthanasia was that the doctor just decides this person's life isn't worth living for whatever reason and goes in there and gives an injection. There is no place for that. And there is no place that's legal or ethical. That would be the family not involved, patient not involved, a surrogate decision maker not involved, simply a decision made by somebody who happened to have a syringe with a lethal medicine. That has to be right down there with murder. And murder is where you kill someone where you shouldn't have. You had no right to. Yes?
Where do they have euthanasia in the voluntary and the non-voluntary? I mean, do you call what you have in Oregon also
No, it's not euthanasia.
You only call it.
I only call it, and it is only called physician-assisted suicide, okay, because the patient has to actually take the medicine themselves. So it is suicide. They have to do it. But if you have ALS and you can't swallow, or you don't even have the strength in your arms to pick the medicine up and put it in your mouth, if you still could swallow, you cannot follow the Oregon rule. Now, somebody could, if I had ALS and I wanted to have this, I could apply for physician-assisted suicide. But if I wasn't strong enough to put the pills in my mouth, Gay could put the pills in my mouth and I could swallow them, and no one would know. But it would be a violation of the law. It would be in my opinion, it would be the ethical right thing to do, but it would be a violation of the law. And no one ever said that there is any correlation or very much correlation between what's legal and what's ethical. The legal system in any country is dependent on all kinds of political pressures and not necessarily on ethical principles.
Karen. Yeah. But we didn't get really... Where in the world do they do euthanasia voluntarily?
The Netherlands.
Only?
Yeah. Only. Now having said that, there's one other term I did. I don't know why I didn't write that up there, because I told you yesterday it was one of the more important ones. And that's terminal sedation. I missed that. I apologize. So one more term, terminal sedation, which goes right in between. I don't know where it goes, but it goes somewhere around in here, somewhere around physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. Terminal sedation is a condition that's usually carried out in a nursing home or in a hospital, and on occasion at home where hospice is involved. Almost always in somebody who is close to death, within a matter of days or weeks or months, who has some type of suffering, and they are placed on very potent doses of narcotics to relieve the suffering. In general, it is felt that this, you get into this, it's the old double-edged thing, where the intent is, I'm giving you morphine intravenously, and it's hooked up to a machine and going drip, 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 and you're getting morphine. And the reason we're giving morphine is to relieve pain and suffering. A side effect or an unintended consequence of that is that it's going to shorten your life, because morphine is going to suppress ventilation. You're not going to be eating because you're going to be in a comatose state. And it is given, and that is an unintended consequence. Death is the unintended consequence.
Let me just say that morphine can also be given under the tongue. It can also be a liquid. It can also be a cream rubbed on the
sure.
skin.
Now we're getting
it doesn't have to be
in the palliative care, but we're talking about terminal sedation. Terminal
right.
sedation is almost always intravenous.
Right, but the other things can be used for
absolutely,
terminal sedation
absolutely.
Too. It doesn't have to be an IV.
Right, but the terminal sedation part, the issue, and some people say this is a wonderful way to treat somebody near the end, is that you're concentrating on pain and suffering, and if death is an unintended consequence, that's fine. And all the ethicists say that's pretty good. The problem is, are you sure of the intent? At what point does the intent become, what we're really doing this is to shorten the life and to hasten the death and to bring about the good death, at which point it falls right into euthanasia. If the patient has involved and said, that's what I want in terms of terminal sedation, it's voluntary euthanasia. Some people critics have called it slow euthanasia. So instead of just giving you a big shot, we've got to give a shot over 2 or 3 or 4 days or a week, and you gradually die. So we are on a very, I don't like to use the term slippery slope, but we are, and the line is not clear that separates these things. Let's take a couple minutes. And we can continue a little discussion informally, and then we will talk about the Terry Schiavo case and how all these things kind of tie into her and how the courts have been involved in some of these issues. Oh, great. Before we go on and before we get too serious, it's pretty easy to get, this stuff can get pretty heavy when we're talking about life and death. I just thought I would read to you, about this is comes from the history of the medical profession. In the 14th century, there were do's and don'ts for doctors. I just thought it might be an appropriate time to just lighten up a little bit. And this is what physicians were told. This is how physicians were educated in the 1300s. Number one, always tell a patient that with God's help, you'll cure him. But tell his family that the situation is grave or worse. So, and we still do this, it's called laying of the crepe, we let the family know this is really, really horrible. So if the patient died, the doctor did everything he could and the patient died anyway, but if the patient lives, the doctor worked a miracle. And as they say, that way you come out smelling like a rose. Secretly determine as much about a new patient as you can before the first examination. Then dazzle him with your knowledge of his general health and condition. Well, you can Google your patients now, and you can find out all kinds of things.
He does this, he doesn't.
If a patient or his family asks you to stay for dinner, do so, but don't get drunk. Frequently bring up the patient's ailment so he won't think the food is more important to you than he is. Never kiss or fondle the breasts of the patient's wife, daughters, or maidservants.
Oh, no.
This is.
Where did you get that?
I got. What do you think I got it? I got it in medical school. Never criticize a fellow physician, even if he deserves it, and that certainly is true today.
Oh, yeah.
And if a patient dies before you see him, tell his family that you knew from hearing his symptoms that he was a goner. So anyway, that's medicine hasn't changed much, has it? All right, Terry Schiavo. What happened to Terry Schiavo? Terry Schiavo brought up a Catholic in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Never filled anything out in advance. She collapsed. She had an eating disorder. There was a lot of problems. She collapsed. Her potassium was low. She had a cardiac arrest and sustained a brain injury. That everybody knows about that. What the public generally doesn't know is that when in the hospital during her hospitalization, there were some screw-ups in the medical care, and she had a second cardiac arrest from which she was resuscitated. And her husband filed a lawsuit against the original hospital and the doctors taking care of her in 1993. It was in 1990 that she collapsed. In 1993, she was in this persistent vegetative state. He filed a lawsuit against the hospital and won $300,000 settlement, plus another $700,000 put into a trust fund for her to provide for her care. That hardly was, I don't know if that was ever mentioned in that there was a malpractice case, that there was this lawsuit, that there was this pile of money out there. The $700,000 sitting there in a fund that was used to support her.
Was that because she was resuscitated?
It was because some of the things done in the hospital were not felt to be appropriate with the kind of medical care she should have been getting. I don't know the details. It was a malpractice case, so somebody probably didn't check a blood test or didn't get the right results or give the right medicine at the right time, and they felt that it contributed to her injury. But her initial injury had nothing to do with the medical profession. It had to do with an eating disorder and some purging and some other stuff that she was going on in her life. Yes?
What is your opinion about why that stuff is withheld?
My opinion about?
About why that information was withheld.
I don't know whether it's withheld. I don't know. I don't know. There's a lot, but it's going to turn out that a lot of misinformation was out there about
right.
this case. We all read the newspapers and we all think of ourselves as experts in some little area. Have you ever read an article about something you really know something about? Is the newspaper ever even close?
No.
So it shouldn't surprise us. So I'm sure if Don reads an article about something to do with geology, he said, well, that's all wrong. That's just totally misleading the public on the way this was written. I read the medical articles and I say, where did they ever come up with that? And I think everybody has that experience. And I think it's bad reporting more than than a conspiracy on the other
not
hand.
Not intentional, probably.
I don't know.
But I'm not completely convinced. I agree that there are certain things that do come up. The husband was very devoted to her during the first few years of this, in terms of taking care of her, arranging for rehab programs, getting her into all kinds of things to see if she would wake up. Became increasingly clear to the attending neurologist, everybody, that this was a persistent vegetative state, that she was not going to wake up. The family, her mother and father, strong Catholics, felt she was going to wake up. They just knew it. They felt it. They had their own reasons for believing that, but it had nothing to do with science. And they felt that she would recover and someday she would wake up and return to a normal life. Her husband wanted to have the feeding tube removed, and he asked to have it. Initially, the family were getting along pretty well, but as that became greater and greater, the separation there, the family wanted the feeding tube and everything continued. When I say the family, it's the mother and father. The husband didn't. He went so far as to say, let's get the courts to become a guardian. I mean, we can't resolve this. Let's get the courts to become a guardian for her. And the courts did for a period of time, for that they were the guardian for her. And then the courts were petitioned to remove the feeding tube, and the courts to another court to see if the people who were chosen to be guardian could remove the tube, and it was upheld that the tube should come out. And the tube was actually removed, I think, in 1994 or 95. I don't have the precise date. The tube did come out for a few days, and then it went to another court, another appeal, and it was temporarily put back in. Well, temporarily turned into years. As this battle went on. In the meantime, he was involved with another woman. He lived with another woman. He could not divorce her for whatever reasons, but lived with another woman, fathered children with another woman. This only made the parents even angrier, that he really didn't have his, quote, his wife's interest at heart, but his wife was in a permanent vegetative state, totally unable to respond to anybody in any meaningful way. Family was convinced that he just wanted the money. He said he wanted what she wanted, and he claimed, and there were at least two other witnesses that said that at some times they had heard her say that she would never want to be hooked up to life support. But no, she never wrote it. It wasn't certified. No proof. The family said, oh, of course, she was a good Catholic. She would want life support. That's the way it went. It got to a point in battling in the courts that the legislature decided to intervene, the legislature in the state of Florida, and in 2003 passed what's called Terry's Law. Terry's Law applied to one person only. Yeah. That generally is not a good way to write a law. It applied only to Terry Schiavo, not to anybody else, and it said that the governor of the state of Florida, which at the time was Jeb Bush, had the total authority. He was the only person that had authority to decide whether or not she was to have a feeding tube. Everybody knew that's got to be an unconstitutional law. I mean, what's the state legislature passing a law? It was called Terry's Law. And sure enough, it was declared unconstitutional in a 9-0 vote by the Florida Supreme Court. That was not good enough for people on a national scene, and we had the federal government, Congress weighing in, President Bush weighed in. One of the physicians in Congress, Bill Frist, looked at a tape, and without examining the patient, saw a tape, and he made a diagnosis. Well, that's not persistent vegetative state. Why, she could wake up at any time. She's responsive. Just absolutely irresponsible. And talk about malpractice. That's, you know, making a diagnosis from a videotape, a snippet of a videotape. During this whole thing, the court had appointed a number of physicians to go and examine her, and they all came back with the same conclusion: this is a persistent vegetative state. And the courts repeatedly, every time a court made a decision, they came down on the side of her husband. Every single time, the courts never came down with the family. They said all of the weight, the preponderance of evidence, all said that this lady would never wake up. Proponent's evidence was that she had indicated that she would not want to live this way. Her husband was legally had the right to do this, But every time, it was another legal maneuver, and it was a huge amount of money poured into the Schindler family from Right to Life groups, some very strong religious groups that felt that she was going to be the poster child and they were going to save her life against these murderous people that wanted to kill her. Even Pope John Paul weighed in. John Paul weighed in at a international conference of physicians. It was over in Rome. And it was a teaching, and it was called, what he released to this group was a document called Teaching to the Faithful. Now, unlike some of his other documents, he does not claim infallibility in this. So this is just his opinion. But it's pretty powerful because it did represent the teachings of the Catholic Church. He said, number one, and there were 3 points that the Pope made. One is that you can't predict who's going to recover. That's the Pope determined that. Now, we have huge scientific statistical evidence that says you can predict who's going to recover. But the Pope is the Pope. He also said, a man is always a man and can never be a vegetable or animal.
Oh, geez.
That was pretty good. I mean, that's so anybody that was going to say she's a... So he misinterpreted a vegetative state with a vegetable. But that may be translating into the Italian, although Italian neurologists also know the difference. And he also said that food and water are natural, even if given artificially, and therefore we have an obligation, and that it's no different than putting a blanket over someone, but putting a feeding tube in. Now, this is, that's the Pope's opinion. The Supreme Court of the United States has ruled in the Nancy Cruzan decision that, in actual fact, placing a feeding tube in and giving food and nutrition artificially is a medical procedure, and therefore falls under this group of refusal. You have a right to refuse or withdraw that, and that's an ethical decision. That is the law of the land. That is not the teaching of the Catholic Church. Yes.
If you saw some other doctor in the state of Oregon make a diagnosis after seeing 20 seconds of a videotape, would you have either the right or the responsibility to refer that doctor for charges or disbarment or whatever you call it from?
No.
I mean,
if the physician was actually practicing medicine at the time, this physician was practicing politics.
Yeah.
So he was not. He didn't submit a charge for his. Yeah. He didn't make a prescription on this. He just made a judgment. But he carried. Instead of just saying I'm a senator from the state of Tennessee, he says I'm a cardiac surgeon. I'm an experienced physician. I'm a well trained specialist professional, and this is my professional opinion. Well, you know, it would be like you making a judgment about how a mountain got there. You never saw the mountain. You just happened to see one picture of it, and you drew all kinds of conclusions. It'd be inappropriate. And because you're the geologist, you get this. Your impression carries more weight. President Bush said the exact same thing. Nobody listened to him. And in actual fact, the American people are much smarter than our leaders, because after this Terry Schiavo case, in one of our medical journals, a statistical study, and they looked to see whether you agreed with the Congress, you agreed with the President. Majority of people disagreed with the President. They disagreed with Bill Frist. They disagreed with the Congress. But a surprisingly large number of people still felt that the feeding tube should remain in Terry Schiavo, predominantly because we are poorly educated. The press missed a chance to teach us the difference between coma and persistent vegetative state, and did not tell us that the American Neurologic Association, which is a group of expert neurologists, have criteria, specific criteria that characterize what is a persistent vegetative state, and that they can predict. Almost nobody in medicine ever says chance of something is zero. And when somebody says that, it is really overwhelming. It's a 0% chance that anybody is ever going to wake up because there is no brain. They did an autopsy on Terry after she did die. To make a long story short, the courts upheld it. Finally, Congress could not they could not, the federal government was going to pass a Terry's Law, and so Jeb's brother could be the determinant. They were smart enough not to do that because they were getting a lot of backlash from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And the tube came out, and she died 13 days later of, you can say she died of starvation and lack of fluid, or you can say she died of the natural course of her illness. They did an autopsy. Her brain weighed about 600 grams. A normal brain would weigh about 1,300 grams.
Okay.
So she had a little bit of a brain. There was almost no cortex remaining. I mean, there was no, I mean, so that was just confirmatory evidence that the CT scans were right. Well, you know, it's a good thing the CT scans are right because your neurosurgeons are using those to operate on living people. So, I mean, the idea that it's a phenomenal case, it's an exceptional case, and I mean exceptional not in outstanding, but exceptional in that it is rare. But it does bring into play all these different forces that are at work in determining how each of us is going to get there to the end of life. And we can be very thankful that the courts so rarely get involved, and that when the courts do get involved, they frequently make the right decision. The courts do a much, much, much better job than does our elected politicians, who are posturing and trying to play to one interest group or another. Because again, we're not going to get everybody to agree whether feeding tubes should be in. There were 25,000 people in persistent vegetative states who still with feeding tubes because family members or somebody doesn't want to say, and they could say, let's get it out.
Yeah.
What are we doing? Why are we keeping this corpse alive? And for what purpose are we doing that? But anyway, that's the Terry Scheibel case.
So everyone in a persistent vegetative state needs ventilation assistance?
No. In fact, none of them do.
No, okay. By definition, you said that.
Now, they might if they get pneumonia, if they get, you know, they in the same way they would have, things can happen to them. And in fact, this was one of the tremendous, in one of the court appeals with the Terry Scheibel case, they had a very good lawyer. The husband had a very good lawyer, and the Scheibels were on the stand, and they said, "Now this is your daughter, and you want everything done to keep her alive." They said, "What if she got diabetes and had to have a leg amputated? Would you want the leg amputated to keep her alive and not let her die?" And they said, "Yes." And then he said, "Well, what if her other leg had to be amputated?" And they said, "Yes, well, of course, we still want to keep her alive." And they said, "Well, what about after the two legs were gone, then an arm?" "Yes." And then they found themselves, they were trapped into this thing. And what about the other arm?